Hello there. You're looking very nice this evening. I just needed to tell you something. Something very important. You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Surprise intro here at Technology Bites Radio.
I didn't even have my ears on.
We only have one form of radio show. Surprise. Surprise in technology. Two. We have two.
Anyway. Really? Among our many.
I just want to let him keep going.
Yeah, don't interrupt him. Just let him go.
First thou takest the holy hand.
One.
First thou takest the Windows 95.
Two.
All right, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
Isn't.
No,
it is. Wait, it is.
That's the joke that keeps giving.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Brewhouse.
And that's the background music to the intro now.
I don't know, we're here. This now?
Perfect show.
Yes, everybody's in the studio because it's getting close to Christmas and nobody loves us except each other.
I thought we were all just in here for warmth.
I thought that was on a different night at KPFT.
This isn't a tauntaun.
Well, if we're not in here for warmth, can I put all my clothes back on?
Although it still smells.
You know, it smells like the inside of a tauntaun in here. Oh, Pete's in town.
Hey-o.
It is a little warm in the studio tonight. No, it was kind of summery.
It was that kimchi burger I just had.
Whoa. Well, if you just had it. We
too much
okay.
Indigestion, man. TMI.
Maybe another 20 or 30 minutes and it's going to get bad out there.
The shields are up between us and them, so we should be okay.
Door's shut.
We'll be fine.
Hold on.
We'll be fine. Yeah. Jay just plexiglass checked the studio. Had that failed, the show would have gone completely.
What if you've been touching? Look at your handprint up there. Good Lord, man.
I'd be more concerned. No, that's not. So here's what's going on there. That's not Jay's greasy handprint. That's the stuff that Jay wiped off the glass with his hand. Yeah, I washed the hand.
I think that's from the e-cig.
Oh, maybe. All right. So we want you to visit us online at geekradio.com. It's our website. You can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com,
cuckoo.
And the channel Tech Bites.
Irk. Cuckoo?
Cuckoo.
Cuckoo.
And
Cuckoo.
We even have all the articles for tonight already posted, so you can read ahead and seem smart.
I literally don't know anything that's happened today, so I guess I should go read that while you do the tech news or something. So that I can talk intelligently about the topics that we're going to talk about.
Don't change anything up now.
Oh, good point.
A bald eagle named Uncle Sam.
Is that what the bald eagle sounds like?
Not quite as threatening as I imagined.
What are you doing?
I'm a bald eagle.
That's not right either.
It was a pretty bird.
You are.
You're a pretty
bird. What
are
you doing?
Who wants some freedom?
Oh, man.
Yes, the holiday season is in full swing here.
It's about to get free in here.
There's freedom everywhere.
You can't have freaky without free.
The perfect show.
This is I missed this.
Really. If you haven't tuned in before, it's just 2 hours of this.
How we're doing.
I was driving through Houston.
Non sequitur bites.
Heard some guy with a
surprise
with an eagle.
Surprise radio.
I didn't expect that.
Nobody expects.
So we got like a tech show or something, huh?
There's a computer show about to happen. Somewhere.
There's all kinds of stuff we got. Look at this list. There's stuff.
We have a computer
show on deck here, and it's aching to come out.
We have to mention too, since it's the top, since at the beginning, we're going to mention the UnDrive. Silent fundraiser.
Un.
Oh.
It isn't a regular fund drive.
All right.
And it's been going very well.
Oh, that's right. You haven't been here for any of this. Lee has been
quite some time.
I know nothing.
He hasn't been around for Dwight some time.
I'm going to show up next week, and there's going to be somebody else in this chair. Some other guy you've invited instead.
Eric Berger.
I was going to say, we're not going to trade you away, but...
Berger will betray me.
It's that guy. Dwight already traded you away. It's fine.
Now, Lee will come into the studio, see someone sitting in his chair, and think, oh, they found somebody for me to sit in their lap.
That's how I roll.
Now, if we do replace, I don't think we should just, let him go. Maybe we should, freeze him in carbonite, keep him on a back burner for a while, and then that way we can bring him out. You know, if Sci Guy doesn't work out
we
so well.
We can tell him it's carbonite.
Yeah. It's carbonite. It's totally carbonite. Just don't move.
It's a gaseous form of carbonite.
Yeah.
Just give Flix another 45 minutes. We're going to be ready to go.
All right.
Gross.
So the UnDrive is where we're trying to raise some money.
Are you really
here.
Doing this for my benefit or for the. For
everybody. Facing benefit. This is for real.
I'm doing it. As if it's for your benefit, but it's really for the listener's benefit.
All right.
This is an aid in radio.
See,
right.
This way it'll be entertaining instead of sounding like we're trying to get him to give money.
I was using you as a vehicle.
Play the straight man. Let's go.
Hey, Uncle Jay, tell us about the UnDrive.
be my vehicle any day, baby.
All right. So the UnDrive is our efforts to just quietly and low-key, in a low-key way, raise some money. Not a low-key way, by the way, so don't do that. A low-key way.
Oh, got it.
I get it.
This is a...
Isn't?
However you get the money.
This is what?
This is run by the Underpant Gnomes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Robert. First you talk about UnDrive, then question mark, and then
profit!
Pledges. Yeah, pledges. This is so, not for profit.
Ooh, see what you did there. So we're quietly talk about, well, not quietly, but, you know, in a low-key way, talk about the fact that we're trying to raise some money for the station because we're listener-sponsored, and for people to go to kpft.org. We don't have the phone set up or anything. Go to kpft.org and make a donation. And just, you know, whatever you can afford and help us make up. We're trying to raise about $150,000 between now and the end of the UnDrive, which I think is the end of the year or something.
A year-end gift is what we're looking for.
Yeah.
Just a little extra something.
Oh, what?
A year-end gift.
Oh, okay.
It's pronounced gift, man.
Sorry, gift. Gift.
I wasn't sure you said... I wasn't sure you said year-end.
Oh, no. I'm reading from the... I'm reading from in here.
Like a euro?
Like a...
No, I know what he is getting at here, but that's not what we said.
Well, so some people
different
have...
Different show.
You're in the wrong, Flicted.
Some people have made some donations. We get a little update, and so we've raised a little bit of money, and we're supposed to come in, you know, a couple of times during the show and talk about the UnDrive, encourage people to go to the website, make a donation.
So KPFT can get a new pair of shoes.
So on the website... They can specify what show they're donating for.
We would like that to be Technology Bites.
The idea behind this is, though, that if we silently do this, maybe we don't have to have quite so many fund drives, full-on fund drives throughout the year. So if everyone gives, maybe we're not going to have to consume two or three shows, you know, coming up.
Or in the future, we'll only have one UnDrive per year, which will last for 12 months.
Don't. Station management may be listening. Shh.
All right, so anyway, we've got that going on. So if you care to make a donation, we'd appreciate it. Go by kpft.org and make a donation.
Whatever you want to give.
We've had some good donations come in, and we appreciate that. And we'll bring this back up in a little bit because, you know, we have to mention it a few times. And it's important to keep you aware that KPFT is a radio station that needs your support.
So. Yeah, just go to kpft.org in case we weren't super clear on that. And there should be a link to the to make your donation.
Absolutely. All right.
10 minutes into the show where the first 3 minutes would have been commercials, you got to listen to us just kind of laugh at ourselves.
Come.
So that's worth some money. Yeah.
All right. So first part of the show will be the Technology Bites Info Shot brought to you from, well, right here in the studio from Peter Hughes. So take it away, Info Shot.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, some of the big news is that next week we will probably be trying out the new way for me to call in. The, like, wired in, better, improved,
dedicated.
This is
where we wire you into DevNull and
dedicated thing. So now you'll be able to hear my dogs and kids in stereo sound clearly without stutter.
Yeah, Pete put up a box at 24.172.3. What was the admin password again?
1, 2, 3,
come on by.
God, 1, 2, 3.
Come and knock on our door.
All right. And then in other news, malware. Isn't it nice that every week there seems to be... I look just to see, and every week there's some kind of exploit, malware, etc. The new one is called Nemesis, not to be mistaken with the Star Trek Next Generation movie that some people hated with the passion, with the heat of a thousand suns.
It was their
and
Nemesis.
Other people liked. But anyways, it hijacks PC's boot process to gain stealth and persistence. Malware targeting banks, payment card processors, and other financial services has found an effective way to remain largely undetected by hijacking the computer's boot-up routine in a way that allows highly intrusive code to run even before Windows loads. The so-called bootkit has been in operation since early this year and is part of Nemesis, a suite of malware that includes programs for transferring files, capturing screens, logging keystrokes, injecting processes, and carrying out other malicious actions on an infected computer. Its ability to modify the legitimate volume boot record makes it possible for the Nemesis components to load before Windows starts, which makes the malware hard to detect and remove using traditional security approaches. Because the infection lives in such a low-level portion of a hard drive, it can also survive when the operating system is completely reinstalled. Nemesis is by no means the first malware to hijack a computer's normal boot process to gain persistence and stealth. TDL, a Windows rootkit that also goes by the name Allurion. Wow, now they're getting where these kits have fancy names, like startup names. Has been doing the same thing for more than 5 years. Let's see. Earlier this year, a security researcher created a proof-of-concept attack for Macs that covertly replaced the firmware that boots up most modern OS X machines. Apple has since patched that weakness. Still, the adoption of the technique by Nemesis as an indication is becoming more viable in real-world computer attacks, particularly those targeting financial institutions. Nemesis hijacks the normal sequence using an installer dubbed Bootrash, or boot trash, however you want to say it. It invokes a multi-step process that involves the creation of a virtual file system that stores malicious components in unallocated space between partitions. That, you know, you've got to give them credit for coming up with that. I mean, on a place to hide, if you're going to hide what you're doing and all of that, putting it between partitions and having your malware have priority before the operating system, you've pretty well gotten past most people and made it really unlikely that they're going to figure out that they've been infected. Researchers wrote that the bootkit intercepts several system interrupts to assist with the injection of the primary Nemesis components during the boot process. It hijacks the BIOS interrupt 6 responsible for miscellaneous system services and patches the associated interrupt vector table entry so it can intercept memory queries once the operating system loader gains control. Isn't that nice? The malware code is stored either in the virtual file system or in the Windows registry, making it largely invisible to normal antivirus programs. That leaves live memory as one of the only places where it can be detected. What's more, unless the boot kit and virtual file components are removed, the malware will execute and load every time the system starts, even if the operating system partition has been wiped and the OS is reinstalled. To eradicate the malware, system administrators must perform a physical wipe and then reload the operating system. That means wipe down the entire hard drive. Significantly, Nemesis won't install itself on computers that use GUID partitions, which were introduced as part of the Extensible Firmware Interface Initiative and are an alternative to the old master boot record. At least for now, use of this newer technology is a key way that financial services firms can protect themselves from this threat. So yet another thing for you to worry about. But here's one where people should be worrying but don't. This is from Ars Technica. People did a study, and there's been between 2004 and 2010, emergency room visits for injuries involving distracted pedestrians using cell phones doubled, according to a 2013 study. Yet in a new survey, few American pedestrians said they were the source of the problem. Instead, those surveys suggested the blame mostly falls on the sidetracked sidewalk dwellers around them. In other words, you're walking down the street, you're just reading a few texts, you're only looking at that, and you bump into somebody? Of course it's their fault. They should have gotten out of your way, right?
This is how people get stabbed.
Yeah, really. The survey conducted by the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons included a little more than 2,000 adults, 78% of whom said that distracted walking was a serious issue for everyone else, while 74% of people said that other people were sometimes or always distracted while walking, only 29% that said that they themselves fit into that category. Still, 26% of people admitted they had been involved in a distracted walking incident, which included everything from bumping into things to falling and breaking bones. Ouch. They hope to raise awareness of the problem, much like previous campaigns about distracted driving. However, they warn that distracted walking might pose much more of a challenge. Alan Hildebrand, an orthopedic surgeon and survey co-author, said there are many gradations of distracted walking. They range from talking to somebody who's walking with you, listening to music but keeping your eyes on your path, to totally focusing on a phone while composing an email message or checking a map. It's hard to draw a line of what's too distracted to walk, and he adds it's impossible to have walking rules akin to the laws about texting while driving, because while the problems are similar, distracted walking is more complicated, he said. It's not a black and white issue. So, I don't know. I've noticed, I've had moments when I figured out I was distracted walking, and it's pretty easy. You step off to the side and finish typing up your message or whatever, as opposed to the illusion that, no, I can walk down city streets and cross in front of cars and all that stuff while I, one hand my big giant phablet phone. I guess at least by studying it and talking about it, then maybe more people will think about it.
Yeah, it's going to have to be an awareness thing. Like kids telling, I'm sorry, parents telling kids, don't run with scissors. It's don't walk with your cell phone or, don't walk in text. So I have seen some people, especially downtown, not all the time, but just, take maybe one step too far into the street, yeah, right at a red light. So they think, I'll just get this one little sentence out. And you get a bus, they hug the corners downtown, and it's going to be a matter of time. And you hear, I guess 2 or 3 years ago, there was a 14-year-old boy that walked off like a 6-foot-high bridge into a ditch while he was texting on his phone just a few steps too far. It's just what happens in those few seconds when you're not paying attention is what gets you.
There was the lady in the mall that walked into the fountain, right? And then one of the security guards recorded the tape and gave it to some friends, and then it ended up online, and then she sued the mall, I think.
Viral.
So why did they write R at the end of their text? Maybe who's dictating?
Well, because you think about it, all it takes is one misstep. If if you've been in a downtown or walked around in a downtown at all, imagine that you walk too close to the curb, so you take that one step off the curb. The next thing you would know, you're in the middle of the lane.
Yeah, you've got bike messengers, you've got couriers coming between the sidewalk and where that traffic ends. You've got all kinds of stuff going on. You really need your wits about you. you know.
Well, so, I've seen people texting while shopping, and there have been a couple of shopping cart mishaps as a result of that.
Oh, jeez. Oh, the only thing worse if you're a Costco person is if they're texting and waiting for, like, the food samples that they have at the ends of the aisles sometime,
no.
where it's the whole crowd
about
there waiting.
About to eat a Pop-Tart.
Yes, must swarm to get free 15-cent, you know, chicken
I wasn't angry sample. Before you started talking about this, but I'm just getting progressively angrier as we go on.
Cool. So now we can. So now, in addition to distracted walking, we can have sidewalk rage.
Mm-hmm. It's already a thing.
But people really do put your cell phone down in cars. I see that so much, like texting and what have you. That's just not a good idea.
Yeah. Be really honest with yourself, and realize that yes, you are distracted when you do that. And you know, just step off to the side. If you're walking down a sidewalk, just step off somewhere. And don't walk while you type. Everything will go a lot faster. I guarantee you'll get your message will be done faster, and you'll probably get to where you're going quicker.
And if you're driving, pull the car over and then make a pledge to KPFT.
That's right.
So that's our public service announcement for tonight. No, another, I guess, not as good news. Although we've talked about this for a while, PC sales for the year. They're expected, according to IDC, they're expected to be down 10% this year, with the tough times continuing through 2016.
Unless your name is Apple.
It's been four years of this kind of reduction in shipment. Although Apple, their shipments have dropped, though. I mean, their profits have stayed pretty good.
No,
Microsoft is shipping more tablets than Apple now. Oh, as wow. of just a few weeks ago.
Oh,
a lot
cool.
of that was, I think, the Surface being dropped, the new Surface line. But, yeah, they are now doing mm-hmm. more tablets than Apple.
So shipments of new personal computers will drop 10% in the fourth quarter, which is two-thirds over now. IDC announced Monday, meaning that for all of 2015, shipments will have declined by 10.3% from 2014.
I think, because I sat in on the last Apple quarterly call, and I'm pretty sure that Mac desktop and portable sales are still up Y over Y.
Wow. That of course, there's a variety of factors for this, ranging from the strong dollar, which makes the computers more expensive, mm-hmm. to larger than expected OEMs and sellers' inventories. The macro reason, the sort of big scale reason, however, remained the same as in quarters and years past. And, you know, we've seen it on this show. Basically, computers have gotten better. They work better, and they last longer without failing. Or without the, you know, operating system going south. So people haven't needed to replace computers on the same cycle as they used to. And then another thing that apparently didn't help is, you know, Microsoft's free Windows 10 upgrade, which was available to hundreds of millions of PC owners worldwide who were running Windows 7 or Windows 8.1 hasn't helped. Because according to IDC analyst Lauren Laverty, the free upgrade enables some users to postpone an upgrade a little bit longer, but not indefinitely. So, you know, research firms like IDC and its rival Gartner have maintained that consumers will refresh their home PCs at some point. Although, you know, some of it, the other thing that they didn't mention here that I wonder about is how many people have maybe figured out that between their tablet, whether that's Android or iOS or their smartphone, that they're kind of covered for at home between there and work, that it does enough. I think it would be interesting to see what kind of study there is on that kind of stuff. The retirement date for Windows 7 is January 14th, 2020. So I guess all the OEMs can just sit and just if they can just hold on for another. For another 5 years, then suddenly everything will be fine because all those Windows 7 machines will be replaced.
Well.
And now one that I don't know, I wondered, I'm sure that at some point you've wondered about, you know, Kickstarter. How many of these are like scams and how them are real deals? Because some of you hear where they got the funding and then they never put anything out or else they folded or they put the stuff out but they were selling it first, and you know, there's been all kinds of different varieties. But so somebody asked that question who was actually like a professor at University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. His name is Ethan Mollick. Did a study on it With logistical help from Kickstarter, he surveyed nearly 500,000 Kickstarter customers, getting response from 47,188 backers. These are actually people who put money in. The project surveyed ran the full gamut of size and type. Every project that raised more than $1,000 was included in the study, and a significant number of smaller projects as well. The main finding was on the failure rate. Moloch defined a failure as one where backers never got a reward or do not expect to ever receive one. Of the projects surveyed, 9% were deemed a failure. So you basically, if you put money into Kickstarter, you have a 1 in 10 chance of backing
it. That's randomly, though, right?
That,
I'm assuming those numbers.
Just that's how many out of all of them, out of all the projects that basically became failures. Overall, 65% of projects were delivered more or less on time, meaning around 25% do deliver, but late. And let's see, there's little difference in failure rate between categories. Tech projects are just as likely to fail as crafts or films. The only variable that has significant effect on the failure rate is the amount pledged. If a project collects under $1,000, it's a few percentage points more likely to fail. I guess that is that sort of weird, you know? It seemed like that if you're estimating and your project thing is going to be under $1,000, that you could be pretty close. As opposed to these ones where, yeah, we need to earn, you know, $400,000. I could see where they could be more off on what
same time, though,
happens.
Shouldn't you be able to go scrape up $1,000 somewhere without having to resort to Kickstarter, you know?
That's
maybe
true
that has
too.
There's a correlation between
so,
that
but,
too.
But
so
but
the
it was
people
only,
that can't get $1,000 or else the ones going
to
Kickstarter.
To be fair, it was only a few percentage points more likely to fail. So I mean, you're not guaranteeing it. It's not just like all the $1,000 projects failed, and it's just more likely to fail than the other ones.
There have been some tech projects that have had a really hard time scaling, to where they thought they were going to maybe produce 10,000 units, and you know they got enough pledges for 50,000, and then suddenly you know just everything changes because they work themselves to death and they're shipping forever.
Yeah,
know?
They also there's also plenty of examples where the reward has technically been delivered, but was not really what the pitch video
right.
said enough to be, quote, a different product altogether.
Like those, real submarines and things they used to advertise in the back of comic books.
Right? X-ray glasses.
Life. Real Frankenstein monster you control. And it's like a poster of a Frankenstein or a ghost.
Yeah.
I remember
be a ghost and get a sheet and a pair of scissors, you know.
Has anyone in the studio done a Kickstarter or backed a Kickstarter?
Oh, yeah. I've backed.
I've backed. I've never done one.
Or not done one. I'm sorry. I meant backed.
Backed, yes.
I wouldn't assume anyone has done one.
Kickstarter and Indiegogo.
Failure rate? Any bad product?
Did you get stuff or is it still waiting?
One didn't get fully funded and it took probably 8 months to a year to finally for the guy finally to like, but he did follow through, which I was happy about. He did do what he said he was going to do.
Did you refund the money or what was?
No, he actually got out the product,
but
he didn't get fully funded, and so he didn't really have the funds to do it for a while. But he did stick to it and eventually took care of it, which was good. Because he didn't do it where you only get funded if you get the full goal.
Right.
And there was another one on Indiegogo that I funded that only got partially funded. And I finally, it was like a year later or over a year later, they sent out an email like, hey, some of y'all joined at this level and so you can get something and we're finally going to be putting one of them out. However, I also did another level where I was supposed to get a T-shirt and a pint glass and stickers or something, and I still have not seen that, and I've emailed them a couple times, and so we'll see. So it's been kind of hit and miss.
You got a picture of the founder of that Kickstarter drinking a beer, wearing a new shirt.
I did do a couple where, like, I helped fund a brewery in San Antonio, I think, to get a canning or bottling system, and that was taken care of. I helped one put out a book on a craft beer bottles and labels with people with beards and mustaches on it. And that one went through and got funded and I got that.
So yeah, you got a lot of experience then. So it sounds like with the exception of the one, the slow, everything kind of came through.
Yeah, a couple of them have been slow and one of them still is incomplete, but it seems like maybe they're working towards dealing with
I've only done electronics once, and then we had at the Geek Gathering, we had a Pi Top, which was out, and I think that came through the route of Kickstarter. The only one that ever folded on me, I put some money into an origami Kickstarter, and it folded.
Clever, but it cleverly folded.
I've done a few software projects, a few games, mostly games, and generally they've completed. I had one, I think, that, I forget which one it was, one that I backed where they didn't hit their goal, and it was, I was actually really disappointing, because it was like a game that looked really, really cool. I was kind of excited about it. And then I've had one or two physical products that I've backed that have smashed their fundraising goal and then floundered for a year plus at delivering hardware.
You didn't back Fez, did you, as far as games go? Okay.
No, I did not. I did not.
Well, in...
I have to tell you something, Pete, too, just for a second. I went out a moment ago to get a glass of water, and they have out in the lobby in the reception area, they have all the radios turned off. The speakers are all off out there, except in the bathroom. So as I walked out there to get water, your dulcet voice was coming from the commode over at me.
Is that why you were gone so long?
Whispering to me from the bathroom.
Not now, I'm on the air. Wait a minute, so are you.
We heard you, actually. That's the funny part. No.
Sure, I'm curious.
Hey, Mr. Talking Toilet.
No, I was just getting water.
Are you
it's
on
right
the
here?
Too?
I didn't go in there. It was too weird.
You're getting water from the toilet with Pete. Got it.
We have a water cooler.
You're the dog. I get it. Drinking from the toilet.
In other news, AT&T today launched its gigabit fiber internet service in parts of Los Angeles and West Palm Beach and announced another 36 metro areas that will get the service at later dates.
I bet you Houston wasn't one of those 36.
Houston is marked at the list. As one, I think.
We were already on the list, but it won't be any part of Houston that you actually live in or have anything to do with. It'll be the rest of Houston, not where you are.
That's the problem.
That
if they offer it anywhere, you know, I would love to see the numbers because...
What's your address? Oh, no, not there.
They mentioned it in San Antonio. Yeah, they have a system where you can tell it your address.
That's
and
right.
They
you have
no.
You have Google Fiber, right, right, Pete?
No. Nope. That's... they're still... I mean, to be honest, Google did say, you know, they're still... They're scouting out the... They've got to still set up for that, but and then
it won't be in your area anyway. AT&T what are you worried about?
Announced their big gigabit thing, but I've not heard anybody who actually has it.
So is the gigabit thing the same thing as gigapower? Are they actually delivering power?
Gigapower is their gigabit internet.
Yeah, it's not coming to Houston. It's coming to El Paso and Lubbock.
No, there was something else. There was another. Maybe it was Comcast.
That's the new locations, but on their map, I thought it was showing Houston.
Oh, please let me be wrong.
I know there was someone.
Yeah,
who
suburbs
is.
Of Atlanta, Chicago, Houston, Miami, and others. It's suburbs, though.
Okay.
Oh, Comcast is the one who's bringing gigabit service to Houston, supposedly.
So we still have kind of like little gerrymandered pockets of non-competition all over Houston.
Yes. Yeah, mostly from how weirdly legacy, how you know, right. Houston is basically built up of annex over annex.
It's $110 for the gigabit pricing used in the Chicago, Houston, Miami, and Orlando metro areas for AT&T. But it is in the suburbs, which probably means the Woodlands, Sugar Land, those kinds of places, and I don't think it will get to the station or anything in interior, or they wouldn't have said suburbs.
Unless someone wants to meet me in between, halfway between the Woodlands and the station with, you know, a few rolls of Cat 6.
Or if you just get line of sight on the top of their house.
Do microwave.
That could work. You could get, you could share in it. They didn't announce pricing for the new cities. The thing that's interesting is these are actually in, they're not. This is finally in places that don't have Google Fiber to compete with. So they're going in ahead. So wow, AT&T, they've really had a change of heart. Or oops, could it be that this is because they agreed to do this as a condition for being able to buy DirecTV?
Uh-huh.
So the deal is, this is not AT&T suddenly out of the goodness of its heart expanding its gigabit Ethernet. It is their contractually obligated. job to put out, you know, because they do things right now. They count Houston as one of their gigapower cities.
as far as them being good citizens.
Even though you really
citizens,
wonder,
you can't get it in Houston, though.
You really wonder how many people. Well, you wonder how many people in Houston legitimately are actually getting the gig. Well, and then the sad part is, there's a bunch of people who basically just are not going to be willing to pay $110 a month for their internet connection, no matter how good it is.
I pay more than that.
Right.
For way less speed.
Yeah, I think we're probably not the typical demographic. Well, so you've got a ton of people who that fiber goes right by their door and they really couldn't care less. Meanwhile, a lot of people who would really love to get their hands on that kind of bandwidth would. Although I must say, I've got 300 megabit Time Warner and it is completely satisfactory. I've not
had. It's better than what I've got.
You know, my kids can have all the streaming video and video gaming and all that rolling, and I don't see any hiccups. So
no, I have 50 megabit down and 10 megabit up, and it's a business class connection, so I have a static IP. But I pay $150-$160 a month.
Once you get to the business thing, it's really. Because I've dealt with businesses.
But I must have that static IP address because I serve stuff out of the house.
I've dealt with businesses and they're paying, you know, it's been frustrating because you're dealing with a business where they're paying two or three times as much as I do for my connection. And I really had more bandwidth than this entire company had available.
Well, and I can tell you for most of it, it's the same. They're not running new wires out to your house. You're using the same node. It's a different tech support number, and if there's an outage, like they fix you first, and that's really all you get. That and there's no data cap. They don't give you a data cap.
AT&T Gigapower, here's one for you. Caps data use at 1 terabyte per month. Although I'm thinking most people it would take, unless you were really doing something unusual, it would take a lot to get to that. You know, because you're not talking about a lot of people busting their 300 gigabyte connection.
Call Dwight and see what he's up to this
see
week.
See if he's gotten past it. They're going to charge $10 for each additional megabyte. I'm kidding. Uh-huh. Each additional 50 gigabytes. And finally, I guess I'm going to add this one because I hadn't seen that it was completed. Our kind of dual top stories. The case over Happy Birthday is done. The trial is canceled. The settlement details are not yet public, but Warner Chappell Music is not happy. So that should mean
it's good
that
for
the
us,
consumers
then.
Have won.
We win.
A short order filed yesterday by the U.S. Chief District Court Judge George King says that all parties have agreed to a settlement, and it vacates a trial which was scheduled to start on December 15th. The key turning point came in September when King ruled that Warner Chappell's copyright transfer was invalid because there was no proof it ever properly transferred the rights from the Hill Sisters, who claimed to have written the song. So they were pretty much in danger of it being over. The lawsuit was originally filed in 2013 by Jennifer Nelson, a filmmaker who made a documentary about the song and about them charging for the song. Nelson was joined by other named plaintiffs who paid money over the years to music publisher Warner Chappell, which claimed the copyright to the song and typically charged a few thousand dollars for broadcast uses of it. If you ever wondered why when you went to a restaurant, they have their like bizarre
happy birthday
song,
the Olive
that's
Garden
why, because they would have to pay Time Warner Chappell or Warner mm-hmm. Chappell Music
it's a public
to
performance.
Get that, to get the right to do that. So that's why they made up the stuff. So, according to Randall Newman, a lawyer for the plaintiffs, no, not that Randy Newman, told Ars Technica via email that, quote, the only statement I can make is that the settlement resolves all issues in the case. He smiled and winked. No, I think that's assumed. So we'll hear what, we'll see what happens. Of course, you know, you could still sing it to your kid. They weren't going to come and see. There's the one that you wonder. So like if a movie star sang uh-huh. it to their kid, or a professional, you know, if professional musician, you know, if Neil Young sang Happy Birthday to his kid, did he have to pay?
That's
a professional.
If he charged his kid to show up to the birthday party, yeah.
Or if
some of those musicians might, so I don't know.
If you were live streaming, if you were like Neil Young and you were live streaming your kid's birthday on YouTube and everybody sang Happy Birthday, yeah, damn right.
Now all we have to fix, if this resolves out the way we expected, now all we need to fix is the unbelievably overextended beyond the life of the creator copyright stuff that's been essentially extended because Mickey Mouse would have been open to the public years ago, and so they've changed it so that anything made right around then is lasts for 75 years after, and so on. That's the last one we need to fix, at least on the kind of
that's
basic
the
copyright
legacy
right.
Of Sonny Bono. Sonny Bono was behind
Sonny
a
Bono and the frozen
of
head of Walt Disney cooked that one up, and then finally our top story, which is very timely and. Is that it has been confirmed. J.J. Abrams wants Star Wars fans to know for certain that Jar Jar Binks and Ewoks will not appear in the next movie
what?
In any way,
why not?
Shape, or form. At a press
so
conference
not real,
Sunday.
It's not going to be a real Star Wars then.
well
I can return my tickets.
You wonder what new thing they've figured out to stick in there. Although the first two movies didn't have any of those.
I think J.J. Abrams could have sealed his fate permanently with Star Wars if the new Star Wars movie opened up with a scene of someone on a speeder zipping through the woods and then lopping off the head of Jar Jar Binks and then totally...
Just accidentally, on
purpose. On purpose. Mows him down.
There was an internet theory that had been gaining some significant amount of support that the new Sith Lord in the movie, whatever his
was
name
Jar Jar Binks.
Was Jar Jar Binks. And that Jar Jar had this entire time been like plotting, there's a couple of websites where you can read this through, and they've got it diagrammed out movie by movie, all the things that Jar Jar did where if you take the view that he actually was evil this entire time, it all adds up.
Right.
But he's not in the movie, so clearly it.
No, there will be a new race called Jarwalks in the next three. Yeah, that's confirmed.
Walk jar.
E-jars.
E-jarwalks.
So, yes, the director of the seventh film in the saga, and it's J.J. Abrams and its producer, Kathleen Kennedy, confirmed that the two most controversial creatures in the six prior films, Gungan Jar Jar Binks and the cuddly inhabitants of the forest moon of Endor, will not appear in the new movie. Jar Jar, in particular, is despised by fans who have made videos of the character's death and even some that showed Jar Jar figures being destroyed with a hammer or pulverized in a blender.
Oddly, kids like him, though, which is weird. Because there have been some documentaries out there, and kids tend to dig Jar Jar. And I'm talking like 5-year-olds to 12-year-olds, whereas it's the old guard that were kids when the first movies came out that despise him now.
Lucas commented extensively on that. In fact, I was reading earlier today, there's a quote from him saying, talking about the character of Jar Jar, how he was written to be just dumb comic relief, and that a lot of people didn't appreciate that. And the way Lucas framed it was that the people who expect the movies to be all like dark and serious don't realize that I write them for kids. They're kids' movies, and they're supposed to have some dumb comic stuff in it. And if people don't understand that, then they forget that they were kids once when they saw the first movies.
And sadly, none of the reporters, when Lucas said that, said, so you had the guy kiss his sister? You're doing this for children?
You know what? Honestly, I don't think he had that part planned out. I don't think he's thought far enough ahead to have actually planned that, the Luke and Leia and I don't think, like,
that
none
they were
of that.
Be brother
I don't think
and
he
sister.
Had any of that planned out.
Someone has dumped out on YouTube, and I know it was out there before, but they've redumped the initial audition tapes for Star Wars 4 A New Hope, which is kind of cool. So you get to see not only the actual cast members that made it, but I think it wasn't Patrick Swayze, who's the other guy that read for Han Solo, and at the time during the reading,
wanted,
his name was Tom
Selleck.
They're calling him Hans.
According to Patton Oswalt, they wanted 48 Hours. Nick Nolte.
Yeah,
and Patton Oswalt does a very good version of what. Oh, Chewbacca, get the hyperdrive and beer cans in his belt.
Yeah, and during the initial readings with Mark Hamill in there, when he was reading with the actor that actually got Han Solo, they were pronouncing his name Hans. So he was going to go in as it was going to be Hans.
Hans Solo.
Solo. I mean, they're just doing it, but the nickname was going to go in as
kissing.
Hans.
It was a whole handsy thing. Oh.
And the best part is, so when they actually were doing all the Darth Vader things, they had James Earl Jones come in later, and they were looking at possible other deep voices. I think they looked at the guy who made Citizen Kane, Orson Welles, to come in and do that. But the concern there was that the voice is going to be too recognizable.
Right.
So they went and they got James Earl Jones. But when they were shooting all of the scenes, they actually had a British actor that was inside. It wasn't James Earl
David
Jones.
David Prowse.
Yeah, and he was actually doing all – he was shouting the lines. So it sounded very much like Dark Helmet, just the way it was like echoey and just kind of rattling around. And they put that out there too. I think this might be just all in you, kind of a shadow ramp up, you know, to the movie coming out. But you can watch that, and you can watch the unedited stuff, and it's a little bit comical, a little bit scary too. Like some little guy, you know, in this big helmet, you don't know what's going on, shouting out the same lines that are in the movie.
Well, have you seen the footage of the first film without the soundtrack.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference too.
Because they didn't have the John Williams, I guess, score initially.
And then I guess we've got to do the obligatory. Everyone's seen where the stormtrooper hits their head. That's the one thing I want out of the new movie. Is I want an homage to that, or a nod to that, or
whack his noggin.
Well, yeah, just something.
Clearly, from the trailers and that one thing where you know that you hope that this is a sign that he gets it 100%. That Abrams gets it 100%. The music, the John Williams score, Star Wars with the wrong music could have failed. I mean,
would've
it could
Star
make
Wars.
That difference. But that music, and Abrams knows how to use it, because that's very rare that you see a movie trailer, because there's been a couple of them where it's like the hair on the back of your neck stands up, kind of like it did back in 76 when Star Wars was in the theater and that music played and the stuff was going on.
Oh, they knew exactly.
That soundtrack was a big deal outside of there, too. We were like in elementary and junior high. They actually played that in gym and all the kids would go crazy. And because the soundtrack, while it did evoke, you know, images of space and Ewoks and all the cool stuff back then, it's a moving soundtrack. It works really, really well all on its own as a musical piece. And in tandem with, you know, some awesome visual effects and a compelling story, it could be really perfect.
I tell you what's got me is the football trailer they released, the one that they did, not the teaser, not the first internet trailer, but the trailer they released during Monday Night Football.
Is this going to be football in the new Star Wars?
Yes, there is.
Soccer.
They call it space football.
It's called soccer in, yeah, the Northern.
It's BB-9. Or
right, that's actually, yes, that actually is the new droid. He is the ball in the game in space soccer.
It's incredibly hard to score in that game.
I don't want to score with the droid.
He will not be.
Much like soccer, fans of Star Wars don't score very often.
Are there wickets?
Yeah. So anyway. What got me was when that trailer came on, there's a moment where it shows John Boyega, who is the stormtrooper guy in the trailer, and Daisy Ridley's character, Rey, or whatever her name is. And she's speaking, it's shown after a moment, she's speaking to Han Solo, and she's saying, like, you know, there are stories about what happened. And Harrison Ford, in his gravelly Han Solo voice, is like, they're real. It's all real. The Force is real. It's all real. And it's like, it was kind of an amazing moment because, you know, in the first trilogy, he's the unbeliever. He's the cynic. Yeah. He's, you know, hokey religions and ancient weapons are no match for a good blaster by your side, kid. And, you know, he's now it's, I forget, I don't know how much later they're setting it, 35, 40 years, whatever. I think they're setting it kind of in real time against the original ones. But now the cynic has completed his journey, and he's now the true believer who is, you know, shouting the truth that this is actually, well, it was all real. Everything about it is real, and it's all, the Jedi is real, and it was a really cool moment with cynicism transformed into faith, and it really resonated with me. I liked seeing him be the one specifically. It wouldn't have worked if it was somebody else.
I think it was also awesome because, you know, you want to see a successful evolution of these characters. Mm-hmm. So you're basically encountering Han Solo and Leia and Luke from
hopefully
as 35 years after they've overthrown or at least, you know, successfully rebelled in the rebellion. So
the fascinating thing, and you know, it's either like just the ultimate, you know, mind flip for people by Abrams, and so it's brilliant if you thought of it, or else there's something going on. Mark Hamill hasn't been doing much in the way of press. He did a thing where he put on a stormtrooper suit and talked to people on Hollywood Boulevard or something.
Well, he was absent too from a couple of press events.
The very
last
recent
year
ones he hasn't been at, so there's just sort of no. They're not showing. He's in the movie. We know that.
Yeah, there were some leaked. They weren't promo
shots. Careful
on
the spoilers. I've been very careful not to see anything. Okay, the only one I've seen is like where I guess. Who was it? Hans, like, ditches the Millennium Falcon in the beet field.
Now
that's the only one
Hans.
I've seen.
Don't say Hans. Spoiler, it's
Hans.
It's Hans.
There have been, okay, then no spoilers. There has been a leaked photo of Mark Hamill, and he appeared to be doing stuff that was movie-related. So without getting any more specific, there was a leaked photo, and it was a while ago, and it wasn't the
video clip of him making out with Liam.
No, wasn't a video clip. It was
yes, of course she's my sister.
It was just
I think that was a Wookiee. Was that Leia?
It wasn't
really hard to tell.
It wasn't a video clip, and it wasn't like an on set photo. It looked like a press photo. It looked like a staged press photo because there was like a white background, and there were marks taped on the floor and whatever. So there has been one photo, and it appeared to be genuine. It didn't look, I mean, not that I'm a, you know, Photoshop expert or whatever, but it looked like a real photo. It appeared to be.
Well, they have already sold, advanced ticket sales are already $50 million for the first day. A figure that has prompted predictions that the film's release will generate between 170 and 209 million
one squintillion
in the US alone. During bajillion, the first weekend.
Hillion, million, squintillion
so,
dollars.
Yeah, so they'll basically make back what it cost them to make this thing first weekend.
What's considered like a good opening box office? Like what's a good, like 50 mil is a good number? What's a good number?
Well,
I think if you make $50 million your opening weekend, you're crushing it.
Well, that's your opening day.
You make $50 million your opening day, you are crushing it.
And so, yeah, so people don't have to wait in line. The thing is, if this turns out... This turns out to be a like massive disappointment to beyond, you know, there's going to be, you know, comic book guy is not going to ever like any, you know,
no,
worst Star Wars ever kind of thing is going to happen every time. But if this is one of those where it gets farther down the, you know, how much you like Star Wars versus like from staggered into the theater and didn't know what you were going to see to like camped out and, you know, wearing your Stormtrooper uniform and with your 10 buddies who also have Stormtrooper. Those, if it gets down into, like, normal people hating it, with this many people going to see it, there could be, like, riots.
If it gets down that low, all you have to do is wait, because Disney, if you'll recall, is doing basically the Avengers thing with this. They're not only going to make 3 movies in like episodes 7, 8, and 9. They're gonna do like the dozen different spinoff
Boba
movies.
Boba Fett, a Han Solo.
Yeah,
movie,
they've got a
prequel.
There's like a. It's not quite Ewoks. A. There's not a. It's not like Rogue Squadron, but there's a set of pre-announced spinoffs. They're already gonna run down. It's gonna be basically Disney's answer to the Avengers franchise. That's kind of what they want to do. Good for them, great.
So then not only would it like be there be widespread rioting and destruction, Disney would collapse and be gone as a company, which would kill Pixar.
Well,
and
how much did they pay
the future
for? How much did
the
they
balance.
Pay for Lucasfilm? How many billions of dollars do they have sunk into this already?
I mean, just to give you an idea, Barrett, Jurassic World opened $208 million.
I am on the same page as you, followed by Marvel's The Avengers at 207.
Is that opening weekend or opening,
opening
day?
Weekend, opening,
opening weekend.
Opening weekend.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
So they're on track to smash that.
I'm torn, though, because I don't want to be spoiled. I want to see it cold.
Right.
But, oh, I so don't want to be anywhere near a theater on opening day.
Well, the thing, here's one, not to... Some theater chains, I'm not going to advertise for one or another, but... Some high quality theater chains
will do pre-sales with reserved seating.
Well, you get reserved seating pretty much every movie you go to.
Jay and
so
I have seats.
And you know where you're going
to
sit.
So we can stroll up to the theater like 20, 30 minutes before, not have to wait in line.
When
not
I was
have to camp out the night before.
Yeah, when I was like 18,
popcorn.
When I was 18 or 19, that was fun. That just ain't fun anymore.
Well, honestly. That's the thing. We're skipping the lines at this point.
Yeah.
Larger seats. You know, you don't have to go creep in. It
the last thing
manageable.
I stayed in line for, stayed up in line for, was camped out in front of Texas Tapes and Records for Kiss tickets back in 1978.
Worth it.
Well,
it
and totally the, and was. What's the worst thing? You're going to see this amazing movie with you and, you know, multiple people, and then you walk in there and have that look for the, oh, hey, why don't you go up 4 rows and sit in that seat, you know, 12
right.
in, you know, between the morbidly obese comic book guy and the guy with the runny
and
nose.
The other.
Or the other guy saving seats who you want to stab because, like, one jacket does not give you 6 seats. It doesn't give you 6 seats, man.
It doesn't even touch all the seats. How can we get... Or you get there and there's the purse that's saving.
One purse does not save 6 seats.
But yeah, so the being able to reserve seats, I think that's another big reason why advanced ticket sales are plausible.
Yeah, you can go and find online. I would hope that as the date approaches, that some of these theaters that have sold out would open up. You know, and why wouldn't you want to open up one more theater?
Because most of them that I've seen show, what is it, Wednesday? I guess some of them can show it Wednesday night.
They can do like a
Thursday
midnight
was the opening. Because I've seen some where it was just the regular evening.
They may be
incorrect or something.
I don't know.
But it showed Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So all the shows that they had listed on all the screens were sold out, and then they were showing the others.
Well, good for them.
So
man.
That's coming up. They can't do Wednesday night.
I think that's a midnight thing. So listing it as Wednesday, but it's got to be a midnight kind of thing. Maybe.
No, I mean, it said the times for the shows.
Who knows?
The thing I saw, but. You know,
what state? What theater?
It was
in San Antonio?
It was in a place where you would go to Verst Fest if you were inclined in, say, November.
It was the Verst.
New Braunfels.
It was the Verst.
But, so that'll be coming up. Hopefully. Geez, our audience would be gone if they had it on that Wednesday night. Or else we'd be broadcasting the show live from Star Wars.
Star Wars IMAX.
You're just going to hear our reactions.
Star Wars IMAX 3D, 10 tickets, AMC Universal. On eBay, sold $999 for 10 tickets.
There's nothing I like that much.
Well, isn't that about what the theater charges?
Only if you get popcorn.
You know, for $999 3D, there should be J.J. Abrams with, like, all the toys acting the movie out in 3D.
Honestly, for $999, you could afford a plane ticket to literally anywhere in the U.S. that has an open seat. And then, you know, the return trip also, and probably a night in a hotel, too. So why buy it on eBay like that? That's crazy. You could just literally go anywhere and see it if you're willing to spend that much.
Probably it's a place like, that's probably like New York City or L.A. or something, where some people have the money and they don't want to wait in line.
Yeah.
They're willing to do that. But, yeah, so, yeah, I figured that the Star Wars story was kind of the top story, and I think that fit. There was plenty to...
As a reminder, if you guys are all enjoying our banter... head over to kpft.org and call in a donation and give us a year-end gift, because that would be really awesome.
He learns quick.
It is a time for giving.
It's right in front
of me. Think about the relief. You know, you've just found out that Jar Jar and Ewoks will not be in the Star Wars movie.
That's right.
Lee is scrambling for relevance after being gone for so long.
Trying to do something.
It looks like they pulled the Wednesday showings. I've checked. Well, just the two that I've checked.
Wonder if what would happen if you had tickets for those.
$999 per ticket.
Woof. I hear music.
Well, you may remember when you were here before.
It's coming from somewhere.
What that music means. It means it's time for us to take a short break and take care of some station business. But we'll be right back after some messages. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's...
KPFT's year-end giving campaign is now underway. During the month of December, we want you to think about all the great things you get from KPFT and to make a secure online donation at kpft.org to keep the radio you love going strong. In just the first few days, we have raised about 20% of a nearly $150,000 goal. That means KPFT still has a long way to go to reach its overall year-end giving goal. We can get there with your help. Again, that's kpft.org to give in support of the wonderful programming you enjoy and the station that makes this diversity possible. This hour, we'd love to thank you for your contribution. Your support of 90.1 is appreciated. Find us at kpft.org.
Did you know you can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. We now return you to Technology Bites.
Surprise! Well, you know, we had a Barrett time last week. Last week was indeed the perfect show. It'll be a while before one of those circles around again.
We'll try.
I'm calling sick next week.
You know, I would have had time to do Barrett time if we weren't having it. We'll have a Barrett time soon. We'll do one more before the end of the year.
Will we?
I will.
A Christmas time, Barrett time?
Yeah.
Christmas miracle.
Christmas time.
Barrett, why
Christmas
didn't we miracle. Have Barrett time?
I ran out of gas. I had a flat tire. I didn't have enough money for cab fare. My trust didn't come back from the cleaners. An old friend came in from out of town. Someone stole my car. There was an earthquake. A terrible flood. Locust. It wasn't my fault. I
I think that covers it. Yes.
That'll do it.
My Russian motorcycle wouldn't work.
No, it did. It actually. I've got an issue with final drive oil. I've had many transportational issues.
Really? How unlikely.
Go figure.
You need an electric scooter.
Do you have a repair manual or is it in Cyrillic?
No, it's I think I might be able to repair it, but at this point I'm not entirely sure.
Why don't
what's
you just
going
have
on.
A second Ural that you can strip for parts?
I'm telling you, I'm just gonna get like, you know, I think I should like branch out into impractical cars. The one thing I was looking at about talking about was just the whole anti-encryption thing is really kind of heating up, you know, especially after the Paris attacks. There was a lot of rhetoric coming out against Snowden, coming out against the use of encryption. And the kind of scary thing that came out today, earlier this morning, was Senator Dianne Feinstein. So she's out of California. She told the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, more or less, she said, this is her quote, says, "I have concern about a PlayStation that my grandchildren might use. And a predator getting on the other end and talking to them, and it's all encrypted. And I think there's really no reason to have the ability with a court order to be able to get into that."
There's really no reason she should have the ability to legislate. But that's how I feel.
So here's
Come
the thing.
On.
Yeah, encryption, one, strong encryption is based around math. Mm-hmm. And even Schneier has come out and said, look, even Snowden, too, they say if you use encryption properly, the NSA does have a hard time getting into that. So you can't really fight math, so you can't weaken encryption. You can put in back doors and stuff like that. And she's already bringing in, like, think of the kids with the grandchildren of the PlayStation and just misunderstanding the situation. But this is her rallying cry, and she's, you know, she's bringing in gaming, which we've seen that go south with, you know, Jack. What was the guy's name that was doing all the fear-mongering?
Jack Thompson?
Thank you, Jack Thompson, and how just people, without even thinking, just, you know, well, it's for the kids. They jump on. So this is what's coming to our shores.
Well, the sad thing is she's so out of touch because let's.
Somebody please think of the children.
Exactly.
Yes, which should rank right up with they took her gerbs.
And then you also had one other little quote, not to steal Pete's news thing, but who said this? Bum ba dum ba dum. I'll come up with a name. Oh, here, Comey. Yeah, here we go, Comey. So
head of the FBI.
Yep, head of the FBI. He says that we see encryption is getting in the way of our ability to have court orders effective to gather information we need in our most important work. We all agree to have to figure it out if we can maximize both those values, safety and security on the internet, and public safety. He says we're not at war. We care about the same thing. And he's talking about being at war with Silicon Valley, that everyone wants a safe internet, but their version of a safe internet is not my version of a safe internet.
I see. A lack of encryption is getting in the way of me keeping the FBI out of my business.
Well, there was a brief time that there were some attacks, and they started talking about, well, we've got to be able to have backdoors to encryption. So it turns out that a lot of the coordination was done
unencrypted. The Paris attacks that you're talking about.
Unencrypted. Yeah. But I noticed on the news tonight they're talking about this recent attack with the Farouk fellow.
San Bernardino.
The San Bernardino attack. And they found his phones and they found the equipment and they were using encryption. And so they're the hue and cry now is coming back up to say, well, we don't know if they've got anything else planned. We can't find out because we can't get into the data. We can't decrypt it. We don't know what the messages were, but here we found these pictures of the school, so we know maybe there's something else up. Oh. So the whole fear right thing that's going on right now is going to beat that drum. And, I mean, when you've got, you know, people like Trump coming out and saying we should, you know, ban Muslims,
right,
and we should call Bill Gates about maybe shutting down the internet for a little while.
You know what? Here's the deal I propose.
Uh-oh. Pete's going to get all riled up now.
Here's the deal I propose. Right after they can assure me that when I put my friggin' credit card in, that it's going to be secure from end to end and not be hacked out and sold or my identity stolen on the internet, once the FBI and the Senate and the Judiciary Committee can guarantee me little things like that, then maybe I will trust that they understand the technology enough to say whether we should do something about encryption. But right now, you could substitute the word close for encryption. You know, oh, with clothes, we can't see exactly what you're carrying or what you're
or
doing.
How about,
so we need transparency.
How about walls is what I equate it to, because there's like, if I want to communicate with Lee and we encrypt our stuff, there's an expectation that there's some, you know, we have the expectation of privacy with our communication. It's the same thing as if, you know, he were to come into my domicile, into my house, we were to close the door, shut the windows, and converse.
Have we swapped keys, by the way? We should do that.
House keys? Yeah, you gave me your house key like first week we met.
Excellent.
Yeah. Don't
you
tell Laura.
Not quite what I meant, but...
here's the thing. So what they're saying is when they talk about encryption, just to swap out the word, and they're saying, well, if we could have seen into their bedroom, we could have known what they were planning. Or if we could have seen into their house, then we would have been able to stop this.
If we could read their minds, or if everybody was forced to say what they're thinking.
Yeah, there are a lot of ifs there, but this is not a golden, you know, it's not a silver bullet.
I would also like to see these people on live television. I would like to see, like Barbara Walters could interview them or whatever, just show them using the internet. And show us how they use it. I want to see how Diane Feinstein. I want a live TV camera.
Well, they have,
she can log in.
She has
in,
aides for that.
You know,
yeah,
right.
I have people
and,
to do that
and
for
if
them.
If you can't do that yourself, then I don't really want you doing very
I'm pretty
much
sure Diane Feinstein is one of those people who gets to Google by going to Yahoo and typing Google in the Yahoo search box and clicking on the results.
And then she sends an email by AOL to the head of the CIA to find out.
Well, I mean, I'll snark.
You know, it has AOL.com address to.
All snark aside, I mean, if you want to assume certain things, you know, about the intelligence and the wisdom, and but that's not what's driving the conversation
right now.
So, assuming that there's some light you can shine on it that's going to say have people like Feinstein go, oh, well, you know, maybe they have a point and their privacy is important. I mean, right now there's just so much fear-driven nonsense going on right now that – sane, valid arguments are going to just bounce off.
Well, that's
off
kind of
it.
My the part of my thing, though, is she, because of being a powerful person in the Senate, is treated with a – she's given a respect
a lot
that
of
I
license.
Don't think is
yeah. –
is
I think
deserved
that,
or
that,
earned
I think
or
that
warranted.
On that particular subject, I would like to see credible – I would – you know, I think that would be very interesting if she actually had to go on. You know, it's like everybody's an expert until somebody's computer is actually broken and – who's going to fix it for reals and who's just a blowhard who, you know, just tells you to install stuff on top.
On the tails of this, Comey also came out after he said all that. He came out and instead of like saying like, you know, the terrorists used encryption to do this, he actually came out and said encryption played a significant role in the killing of two people during a shooting in Garland, Texas earlier this year. So he's saying encryption played a role in the shooting. So it's like, well, I don't know. I've never tried to fire a PGP
my
key at anybody.
So did automobiles.
Fingers and played a gun to the gun. I mean, it's just one of those things where they're pointing at, you know, it's like, well, we should ban.
I will say that the most
nobody would be killed with a gun.
The most cogent argument, in, you know, playing the devil's advocate, the most cogent argument, and it's being, they're learning. What I saw in the news tonight is they're learning because people are saying, they're presenting good arguments against letting people get it, backdoor encryption, but they're learning from that, and they're saying, you know, look, we've got this situation here where we've got data. It's encrypted. It could help prevent another terrorist attack.
Well,
we have no way
it's,
in it.
Yeah,
possibly.
Just a tiny step away from, and what they're trying to imply is the the bomb is ticking, and if we don't have breakable encryption,
and people,
we can't stop it.
And people will respond to that because they're afraid, and because if we think we've got a hard drive full of data that might conceivably prevent another terrorist attack, and we can't read it. I mean, we basically, you know, you've been pulled over, you've already committed the crime, we've arrested, we have the right to seize all your property, and there's just that encryption is preventing me from now seeing this part of your life.
Well, the corollary to what Pete said earlier about, you know, like the last series of attacks, the Parisian attacks, not using encryption, it's not that they could pull it off without using encryption, it's that they didn't use encryption and we still didn't catch them.
Right.
Right. You know.
Well, that, I mean, that's a very salient argument, and it, you know, there's, even if they knew, I mean, there's plenty of opportunities for this. One of the things they talked about with the with this latest San Bernardino attack is that they're going to look harder at these fiancé or marriage visas because the vetting process may be a little weak on that.
But
there are some, and it's unfortunate, there are some reasonable things that they're talking about doing, but I mean, right now, the bluster of ignorance coming out because of all of this is what's overshadowing it. What's going to erode the most freedoms and the most privacy that we have is the fact that somebody like Donald Trump can say with the things that he's saying, and that people cheer that.
Well, so what you brought up, that the answers to the fear is to give away the security of encryption, because it's not just about keeping terrorist stuff, you know, terrorists keeping things away from people. It is about how they secure your personal data that you care about and make that not available to hackers, etc., or private conversations that you have. You do have that right.
You do, especially when most folks are using an email provider like Gmail that that scans your email to, you know, find ad keywords and insert stuff in there. And if I want to have, you know, if Barrett is a buddy of mine and I want to have a discussion because I'm making this up, I don't actually have this disease, but I have some sort of like horrible incurable disease, and I don't want, you know, I don't want Google or anybody else learning that I have, you know, whatever this horrible disease is. I want to talk to Barrett about it.
I need to get checked out.
this is why I have this, because we both were around Jay and his vaporizer, and I want to make sure that you and I don't have popcorn lung or whatever. And I'm emailing you. I would prefer to do that encrypted, frankly. Anything where I'm talking about personal data like that, where it's going to traverse
health information,
where it's
going to
traverse
webmails,
any kind of internet service that is known to scan and associate that data with you for purposes of ad delivery and behavior tracking and all that stuff that's endemic nowadays, you're damn right I want to have all that encrypted. I don't want that data going out there. I don't want, and you know, perfect OPSEC is impossible, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, There are folks who I communicate with. I've got a fellow that I worked with at a past job who is extremely insistent on using encryption for any email. Any email we exchange is encrypted, and he doesn't. I mean, and he's maybe a little further down the crazy curve than a lot of other people are. But you know, it's not like, I agree, Pete. It's not like we're just attempting to, you know. This is not an issue that only is, if we outlaw encryption, the only thing we're trying to do is fight terrorism. That's absolutely not true. You're depriving citizens of the right to communicate privately. It's just the reality of the world that we live in, where electronic communication that isn't encrypted, you can almost count on, no matter what kind of communication it is or who it's with, you can almost count on it's being monitored by some third party, generally for monetization for some purpose. It's just the way it is.
Right.
Ads.
Yeah.
It and some of it is that the problem is there are people who benefit from playing the fear, you know, politicians who get whatever thing it is that they wanted get through, so they benefit, so they do it, you know, so they put it out there. If you kind of want to get realistic,
kind of
my sort of, I'll do 10-second rant, is we're all going to die at some point. And if you want to look at what's the big, oh my gosh, we're afraid because 100 people with a big coordinated attack were killed in Paris. 3 people were killed in Colorado Springs, and 14 people were killed. And every one of those deaths is horrible and terrible and sad. But in the scheme of the 9 billion people on this planet, it's not big enough. The deal where we, you know, I think that it is borderline a scam, or it's a weakness of the media that we are so afraid of something because we hear about it. So you hear about Paris and it's in real time. You know, they can go right to, you can see people live and experience it. But Paris is 13 hours away on a plane if you hurried. And it's not, you know, they're not going to, you know, the next place they're coming is not, you know, Spring, Texas, or, you know,
this is the bad part. We talked about this earlier. In 2013, 3,154 people were killed in motor vehicle accidents involving distracted driving. So on cell phones.
Right.
So, yeah, I think
I mean,
we should go after
you're more likely to get killed by a distracted driver than a terrorist.
So apparently Apple and Google, the Android operating system and iOS
are bigger
worse
killers.
Terrorists yeah. than well, and iOS does have encryption in it.
Well, the Trace.org put out an interactive map of gun deaths in 2015.
Oh, I saw that.
And you can take you can put in your city, and you can see like all the way down to the street address of where someone was killed or injured by a gun.
We don't have any fatals,
so,
do we? Really?
So we're kind of doing the terrorist job for them when we, you know, this gets said kind of every time, but I don't hear it enough on the media. The fear is how that works. Us changing what we do is how terrorism works. And then to bring it back closer to our what we usually do. If you're afraid about a predator coming after your kid who's on his Xbox or his PlayStation,
maybe you should monitor that like a responsible parent.
What guy who's old enough to be a predator that you're afraid about is going to be good enough at Call of Duty that your kid isn't just going to be spending his time like,
Pete stole my thunder.
Owned you.
The predators are the 8-year-olds. I tried to play. No,
it's like
they're
headshot
mean.
Robots.
I learned new bad words and got like, you know, horrible things done to my, you know, my video game corpse by these 7 and 8-year-olds, and I cried and ran away.
You know, it's sort of the, hey, why don't you meet me at my van? It's like, no, how about I blow your head off?
Well, as always, and to wrap this part of the conversation up.
And that's it for Barrett time.
As always, the people that are attempting to legislate things in regard to technology have the least understanding of the technology.
It's not just the least understanding. They're also, in my opinion, some of the least trustworthy people to be involved in it. Because the argument for backdoor encryption that's advanced by proponents of it is that it should only be like an encryption method with a government-accessible backdoor.
Yes,
should only
correct.
Be accessible after due process is followed in the event that there's a pressing national security issue. There's a reason for a valid disclosure of this backdoor. And this is the same set of people saying this who are massively abusing the national security letter process, who are massively abusing data collection, who are abusing warrants, who are allegedly abusing cell site simulation, who are all these things where the due process that is supposed to protect the things that we have from unjust seizure and unjust search is the same due process that would allegedly protect a backdoor key from being brought in and used. And everyone in a position to approve that has already proven that they are absolutely irresponsible.
Unless they have the data, they can't shepherd it very well.
No. They're completely irresponsible with using it. No government agency that has been trusted with the ability to procure protected information after the empowering stuff that's been done after 9/11, particularly with Patriot Act stuff, has stuck to the process. The NSA is the records disclosed have proven that they have not just abused is too nice a word. They have absolutely run rampant with unauthorized data collection, all the way down to individual NSA agents in data collection actively using the NSA tools to spy on girlfriends and love interests.
It's called love interest.
Just
word
because,
for
like,
it.
I'm sitting here bored at my console, let me go pull up this girl at the bar gave me her email address last night. Let me just go Gmail backdoor into her account and read her emails because just for the hell of it, because I'm sitting here and I can. And these are the people who want the backdoor encryption. And I absolutely trust them about as far as I can throw the Pentagon. And that's
I've heard,
not very
though,
far.
They're
you shouldn't be throwing anyone with your bad arm, Ed.
Pretty much.
they're making a commercial, though, with the head of the NSA standing in a data center saying, we know that we collected all your phone calls and the courts just made us stop, but trust us. If you give us the keys to your encryption, we'll be responsible stewards of that.
Yeah, so supposedly that came to an end last Sunday. Was that the deal or a week ago last Sunday?
I think I think that you have to have like lawyer like precision. The program, that specific program, yes. and whatever monitoring or keeping of data that was tied to that exact specific program ended on Sunday.
Another program.
Whatever
doing
other
it.
Stuff they did or whatever's going alongside yeah. that does exactly the same thing, well, until that gets revealed into court, you won't hear about
it. No, we have kind of picked up some of the things from their playbook. When they say, we are not doing this, it means that, yeah, you aren't doing it, but they're doing it through some other agency or someone else is doing it or that.
Or
this program's
rule.
Not doing
yeah,
it.
Well, we
we're very good at side
two.
Talk.
We, the PR folks on stage, we're not doing any of that. It's the guy in the back room who's doing
right
it.
Now, I am not collecting right. your email. Wink, wink.
I did not surveil that woman.
We ain't doing any of it. It's so, Jay yeah. Lee back there doing it.
Jay Lee is the man behind the curtain.
I got some more ketchup advice. I'm
just... sending them out to the NSA. But
hey, as a reminder.
Did they find any ketchup evites in Hillary's rogue email server?
Not that I know of.
Hmm.
They did find improperly secured secret information, which leaked and all kinds of
other... So that's
the
thing, too. Not to, we'll totally get off this, but before you go attacking everyone else's stuff, maybe make sure your own house is secure.
Well, no. It's not inadvertent disclosure and classified data spills when I do it.
Yeah.
It's only when they do it. When I do it, it's just like, this is what I needed to do to get the job done. I mean, give me a break.
Here's next. Oh, come on. Gives a nice change in tone.
I don't know what's happening anymore.
Only got a couple things. This one is an Apple story that I think is bigger than an Apple story. If you use an iPhone, if you don't, well, then this probably... Then just wait a minute, and it'll mean something to you in a minute. when Apple Maps first debuted alongside iOS 6, it got a lot of criticism for inaccuracies in mapping data and stuff like that, and people really were, then the Google Maps came out with a native Maps app for the Apple platform, and that was very popular. And then Apple has improved it, but now they have said that Apple Maps is used 3 times more than Google Maps on iPhone.
I believe that because
yeah, it's
right
default.
There.
Yeah.
You
right.
just press it.
And that is the thing that is starting to change that I think, you know, I'm a big Apple fan. I own a lot of Apple stuff. But this is the point where people need to start keeping an eye. Because what is the reason that Apple Maps is used 3 times more than Google Maps? Because it's integrated and automatically, if you click an address in Safari, which is the browser you get unless you take extra efforts to install one from iOS, if you click Map stuff, you go to Apple Maps, and there's a point where this becomes anti-competitive, and I think that's something that people need to pay attention to. Now, it's good. Integration is good, and it's helpful and all that, but this is something where these kinds of utilities and how they're used and how they're presented to people, I think that's something to pay attention to.
I also read somewhere that iOS was, like, by far the preferred operating system on all the iPhones, which was weird. But apparently most people like that.
Although although Apple has the most fascinating setup with that, you know, they make all the profits in the phone business, and that might sound like hyperbole, but essentially Apple makes the majority of the profits, the money beyond what it costs to make the phones, compared to all those Android providers. They make more than half of the profit, and but. They sell a lot fewer phones. There's a lot more Android phones because you can get, you know, even really cheap ones, really cheap, crappy ones, you know, $7 phones or whatever. So they don't have a monopoly, really, but they make a lot of money. And, you know, it's kind of it's an innovative model to not be a monopolist and make more money than the people who are really putting out the volume. But I do think that that it's getting to be time where there needs to be attention paid to how this works on the iOS stuff, because the iPhone has an architecture where you can add these other apps. And so you could add Google Maps, and certainly a lot of people do, or else there'd be, you know, it'd be more than 3 times.
Is that free?
Google Maps is free.
Yeah, it should be free, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't too sure. Okay.
Yeah.
But believe it or not, the as a Microsoft app, they want $3 for it, or $2.99 or something.
Google?
For the Google Maps under Windows 10, under what they're portraying to be Google Maps on this. Now, I can do Chrome and just go do whatever I want to in Chrome. But yeah, Windows 10, for whatever reason, in the Microsoft App Store, there's Google Maps for a couple bucks.
Weird, because basically, if I'm on a laptop, which if I was happening to use a Surface Book, I would be treating it as a laptop, and I would be just going to my browser.
Well, the Google Maps app on the iPhone is also a paid app.
Well, that's what I was asking.
Is it?
Pete,
I thought it was
so
free.
Saying no.
Nope, not the actual app. No, there's the Google Maps app is, and I keep because I was trying to use it. See.
Now there are other people that have packaged up the Google Maps app for free on the Microsoft Store, but I don't know if I would trust that.
No, I have it from way back. I've bought very few.
Maybe they changed and charged for
I
it because I got it for free
it.
Also.
Maybe we should Google this.
Let me take a look here. I'm going to the iPhone Store. I've still got it on the PC. Let me see. I still have it on the phone.
My
I think it was
phone. It was free, and
I think it was. I thought it was free too, but I went to. Do something with Google Maps, and I think they wanted to charge for it.
Oh, they're charging you for each time you want directions, but that's different.
Yeah.
That's in-app purchases.
Maps of your actual hometown or places where you might be visiting are extra. I may be thinking of My Maps, which is also a Google product. Yeah, I've got the app on here, so it might be the My Maps app. There's a Google My Maps.
Yeah, it says, well... Yeah, it looks like it's free from here.
It is free. My mistake. My Maps, which is also a Google product, is $2.99. It's Google Maps with directions, street view, and place, and all that. There's an app. It's $2.99.
Hmm. Well, yeah. But it is time to look at in these environments to look at the, you know, the operating system is a framework where you can put apps in and use them, and that tight coupling. That was a problem with Microsoft, and I will say, to be consistent, you know, I was against it when Microsoft was doing it. I think that it deserves watching with Apple.
What's kind of coming back around, I thought we had kind of gotten past all that once we went to desktops and workstations, where for the most part, the software looked the same under OS 10, the software looked the same, you know, to Microsoft. But now, with the tablet revolution, and with, you know, with Windows 10 kind of being tablet-y, with everything else being folded, there's definitely two camps of apps again. You know, they're splintering again, it seems like.
So, you know, clearly, you know, it's good to have that competition, but I do think that may be something to be watching for. In other interesting news, you know, Apple unveiled Swift 2.0 at WWDC, the Worldwide Developer Conference, back in June. One thing that they mentioned, and we may have talked about it in passing, was that the language was going to go open source by the end of the year, and it is now the end of the year, and Apple has launched Swift.org and is releasing a big chunk of code, as well as some guidance for Swift 3.0 to the public.
Barrett, Swift, are you developing in Swift?
Swift is
no.
being released under an Apache 2.0 license.
I bet they're going to ditch it if they're open sourcing it, though.
I think
they tend
Swift
to switch.
Was sort of their future
was it?
Thing.
Are they still going to hang on to it? Because they tend to ditch tool chains every 3 to 4 years and leave a swath of developers kind of being angry and shaking their fists. Whereas, you know, with Microsoft, if you learned VB in 1990, you're set.
That's true. Yeah, there's still Swift sounds like it's their thought that it's the future. But
well, Objective-C, I think a lot of people learned and got burned on. Possibly.
Yeah,
and then Coco, and then, you know,
it's hosted. The project is hosted on GitHub and includes the compiler, the LLDB debugger, the REPL command line environment, the standard and core libraries, and code from supporting projects. New to Swift and also open source is the Swift Package Manager, described as an early stage project that will serve as a repository for Swift modules and will evolve with input from the community. I think, you know, well, Apple also has posted information about the next version of Swift. Instead of getting a big Swift 3.0 info dump at WWDC 2016 in the summer and then digging into the Xcode betas and adapting, developers can already find an evolution document on the Swift site that maps out where the language is headed in its next major version. It seems to me, you know, and I applaud it if this is the way they're going, it seems like that Apple is recognizing the power of open sourcing and moving forward that way, that that's really where programming languages seem to be going. You know, the ones that are more successful, you know, Java tried to kind of keep it all under their roof, and it's not been successful. But then you get like PHP and Python and you know, any number of other ones. And I think this, you know, knock on wood, you know, we'll see as it goes along because it's only just happened. But I think this is a positive step towards where my kind of guess is that the future is going on programming languages. They should be open like that. We should be avoiding the deals where 20 years from now we find out that some module that everybody's been relying on as rock solid because they never bothered to look at it has holes and problems in it, and that cause big problems because we've depended on it for so long that everything is hooked to it. That this kind of thing is going to help open that up to where people are going to find those holes, where they're going to get fixed more easily, and where, you know, you put enough people on it. I think it may be Apple realizing that the power of all those people out there working on this stuff overwhelms what even a huge successful company like Apple can do by themselves.
Yeah, it's still tough though, because what they're doing is they're taking a large, you know, section of developers and they're saying, okay, developers, learn Swift, but in doing that, you're only going to be able to develop for Apple. And that's what it is. Swift is not only relevant inside iOS. Well, you can't take it to Android. You can't take it to the web. You can't take it anywhere else. It's just for phones for the most part.
I guess if it's open, hopefully with it being open source, it means that more people can do something with it.
Yeah, but only on iPhone, though. You know what I mean? So it's like, come on in to the garden. We're free temporary admission to the garden.
It is at least with the, you know, compared with, you know, not compared, paired with the other story, it's an openness that means more people can do stuff for it. So they're not doing where, oh, yeah, you know, you can. We've got our closed garden and we've got our closed entry to the garden and our closed tools to put anything in the garden are closed, etc., all the way back. So we'll see. You know, on the, like I said, the plus side of them making it more public and being willing to be transparent on it, you know, especially given their proclivity to like pull the rug out from under the development community every few years, as opposed to, I guess, Microsoft's thing of like bogging itself down with all the legacy code that goes with having the old.
Maybe they want. It looks like they're trying to like make a play for corporate apps, which would be kind of a good place for that. Because really, Swift kind of shines when it comes to like game programming, and then when it comes to doing some relational stuff and like heavy kind of lifting with business apps. And maybe that's what they're trying to get in.
It's kind of a funky thing. The type of applications that it seems like they want you to make are applications that fit easily into categories on the Mac App Store. It's like, you know, make this really awesome notepad replacement or whatever. There was one really high profile app, and I'm totally blanking on the name, Sketch or something like that it was called, I believe, that just backed out of the Mac App Store because a lot of different reasons, but it was essentially the walled garden tools, which include Swift, don't necessarily give you the ability to produce applications that have deep system-level hooks that can do really complex things, unless you're Adobe or Microsoft or Apple and you get the unlisted APIs that can actually produce extremely deep, complicated applications like, you know, Lightroom, the Office suite, a lot of the Mac applications, you know, Final Cut, those things.
But your lone developer will never have that kind of access.
No. You will never, like, you with Swift will never program a video editor on the same lines as Premiere or Final Cut. It's not that you even if you have the skill to do that, maybe you're an ex-Avid employee or whatever, you simply don't have the API calls available to you. They're not in your development environment. You cannot use them. Yeah, it's disappointing. And I don't think, and now you have to correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not a developer, but I think that if you were to sit down with on a Windows machine I'm blanking. Oh my gosh. The development tool, not
like Visual Studio or something.
Visual Studio. God, thank you. Yes. If you were to sit down on a Windows box with Visual Studio, you could, assuming you had the ability and the resources, program they're still hidden APIs, but you could program like...
you can get into a lot, and then you can get aftermarket libraries to get into other stuff, and then you can even go write assembly if you want
to. You wouldn't be making the next Microsoft Office, but you could make an extremely deep, complicated application with system-level hooks that does funky stuff that you would not be able to create in on the Mac.
Well, you know what? LibreOffice and OpenOffice have both been ported to Windows, so arguably you could, you know, with just a C language.
Okay.
You know. People have done it. Non-Microsoft people have written Microsoft suites, Microsoft-like suites, to go on the Microsoft operating system. And that's one of the awesome things about software is you can, you know, take some software and, you know, not necessarily easily port it, but, you know, take it other places. And this is just it's very much a play to drive a wedge in between Apple users and everybody else. Now that I've got a Microsoft notebook.
You're freaking out, man.
I'm telling you, I was never this vocal about this before.
In the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day. But can they stand a dip in the snark tank?
With you in the studio, couldn't you just bring a set of bongos and do that yourself?
Like I could remember and repeat the same thing every time and every time. Hey, kids, you want one of those cool hoverboard things for Christmas?
All right.
If you get the right ones, apparently some of them explode or catch fire.
Woohoo!
All right.
Oh, wait, no.
They're not fry, just
fry.
They're not
try just... bry and fry.
In that order. They're not just exploding in popularity. They're literally exploding. In the past few weeks, there have been several reports of hoverboards exploding and or catching fire. There was one in Boca Raton, Florida. Of course in Florida. But Gulf Shores, Alabama. Or one that's blamed for destroying a home in Louisiana. In most of the reports, the fire appears to start due to faulty chargers for the lithium-ion batteries that power hoverboards. You know, remember, the more power you put into that battery, if you don't manage it well, that's when you have problems. You know, there was back in the early days, if you think back, Apple had one of their first lithium-ion battery laptops like caught on fire, and it was a big deal because it was like in one of the prototypes, or you know, they were showing it to somebody and it caught on fire because they were still working on how to do it. And of course hoverboards are mostly made in China, and so it's not necessarily There's not a lot of safety rules or any of that kind of stuff associated.
When the first ones kind of appeared, like the mini Segways, they were a couple $1,000, and they were being offered by like one or two reputable companies. And then there was a big thing online where it was like, oh, we found out where you can get them for like $300, and guess why you can get them for $300?
Yeah, there is that whole get what you pay for concept going on here. And apparently, you know, like you said, most if not all hoverboards are made in Shenzhen, China. And then lots of different companies buy them from them and then sell them. So it's really hard to know which ones are at risk. But so at least knowing about it, you can kind of look into it. You may be able to one of the things would be you can look at the different articles and kind of see if you if it's one of the ones that was in danger of that, then maybe you could learn that and not buy one for, you know, your little fragile flower snowflake who wants a hoverboard, which I know it's a big popular thing. I hate the fact that they call them hoverboards because they don't
not
hover.
A hoverboard.
It does not hover.
I guess you hover for a couple of seconds if it explodes on you, but that's not really that wasn't really the point of it. Here's some free stuff so you can try it if you want and it doesn't cost you anything. Or some of this you can actually just use it if you want and it doesn't cost you anything. This one is interesting. The U.S. Postal Service is rolling out a new service that emails you scans of the mail that you'll be getting.
Tell if it's been stolen?
You'll know what's coming the next day. So if you're wondering what's going to be delivered.
Oh, just the outside?
It's just the outside. The USPS has been testing the service called Informed Delivery in some zip codes in Northern Virginia since 2014. And it will reach the New York City metro area plus selected areas of Connecticut beginning this fall. Then it's going to go to other areas in 2016. Right now, it only sends you scans of letter-sized envelopes.
That's kind of lame. You'd think if, like, the NSA was already opening everything, they would just scan the full thing before, you know, getting the Steam opening.
Well, apparently they scan everything anyways, and so that's why they started this this project. Once you sign up, they'll email you a notification before 11 a.m. daily, Monday through Saturday, containing a grayscale images of just the front of your envelopes for up to 10 pieces of mail. The idea is that you can get a preview of what you can expect to come home to at the end of the day, in case you're waiting on edge for some crucially important piece of mail. Frankly, I from my point of view, it would let me know if I want to bother to go out to the mailbox. You know, we have the new thing where it's that most people, unless you live in like an older neighborhood, where it's the central mailbox where there's 400 little boxes with the same numbers. That was one thing I've always wondered about, is how come there's like 7 deals of them and they're all 1 through whatever, so you have to memorize like which column over is your, you know, I'm number 7 on the 5th one from the left or the 6th one from the right.
It's got to be a weird USPS numbering thing from way back where you go, you know, top to bottom instead of left to right, because that seems
well,
universal.
Why not, though, go, you know, if there's 50 mailboxes, I know why, because it's cheap. You do, each box has 20 of them in it, and you go 1 to 20 and just stack them up. You don't have to have extra numbers.
All the different denominations, yeah.
But so it does, you know, especially for those of us who have centralized mailboxes, you can know whether or not you can skip that walk down to the.
Now, I never thought about that, but if they are scanning all the mail, then they know everything coming in and out of your mailbox, which is, you know.
Pretty much. Well, at least that's public, you know. It's not like they're going into your house and finding the stuff you're gonna mail. That note. They're not coming in and scanning the note that you personally hand-delivered to somebody else because you wanted, what's that thing that we want to have privacy? Anyway, so...
If you're not doing anything wrong, you got nothing to hide.
Then you should write your note on a white T-shirt and wear it and walk proudly down the street saying, please go to the clinic and get checked.
Terrorists could be passing messages back and forth in greeting cards. I think those need to be seriously...
Well, they talked about soccer games and birthday parties and weddings and terrorist stuff.
They could use a verbal code.
So I think they need to open up back doors to birthday parties.
We need to just all sew our lips shut.
Look, kids, it's Curly the Clown and the security guy. He's just checking.
We have to ban birthday parties, even though we just now got it to where we can sing happy birthday. Now we've got to ban birthday parties.
Irony.
Man.
The other free thing is you can download, if you want to be kind of preppery, but you want to learn it from the best, there's a guide called Disaster Preparedness Tokyo, which is the Japanese government's, like, document PDF. It's in English, so you don't have to worry about translating it or any of that. Although you can, for the purposes of this story, the audio and my mouth are not in sync.
What kind of disasters are in there? I'm going to ask the obvious question. Is there a giant lizard attack disaster in there?
Mothra. I don't know. I think that they probably lump them, just like we lump zombie apocalypse with most of our disaster preparedness. They're just, the Godzilla prep is a given.
You know, Godzilla actually usually comes to save the city from something else that's even more horrible.
Mothra.
No, Mothra was... Was
Mothra battled
good?
Godzilla, I thought at one point.
Mothra was good.
We will find out what Pete does. And...
I'm sorry, this totally derailed GP.
The Disaster Preparedness Tokyo Guide, subtitled Let's Get Prepared, was designed for Japanese residents to prep for an earthquake and other potential disasters hitting Tokyo. But it pretty much offers universal things you can do to stay safe in an emergency wherever you are. They show you stuff like how to turn pants into a backpack,
sweet,
how to make an emergency pants lantern pack with a plastic bottle, and much more.
How to survive a disaster or how to be a ninja?
How to be a MacGyver American type ninja. If you go to Geek Radio, if you go to geekradio.com, there's links to all the articles we've talked about tonight and this one in particular where you can just download the PDF. It's at least worth, I would think, this is one of those, you know, it's a freebie, it's got useful type tips, and, you know, given that it's free, you can download it and stick it on a tablet or stick it on a Kindle or whatever, and you have that free reference. You can read it, and if you think, well, I already knew all those things, I knew how to make a backpack out of pants, Step and one.
All my backpacks.
In the
pants.
Navy, I learned how to make a life vest out of a pair of pants.
Could you take stuff with you with it? Is it like a pants, life vest, backpack?
The tough part
just,
is com-
just
combo?
The ability to float. You can and be pantless in water.
I learned how to make a car cover out of my Uncle Leroy's overalls.
So apparently, Mothra stepped in to defend Tokyo against Godzilla.
Really?
So Mothra, good person. Godzilla, bad person.
No, but Godzilla always is there to save
the
Tokyo.
Movie. Not in this one.
Gojira loves the children.
He does.
That early on, he was the problem, and then later on, it turned into where he was the kind of. Well, we're not sure, but he does seem to be acting more in our interests than against versus whatever creature of the week had shown up.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, Mothra versus Godzilla, 1964. Humanity appealed to Mothra for help against Godzilla's aggression. Dun,
wow.
Dun, dun.
So
you know, if you watch Godzilla backwards, it's about a giant lizard who helps rebuild a half-burnt-down city, then moonwalks back into the ocean.
Yeah, that sounds completely
That's
legit.
Awesome. What I'm watching when I get home tonight.
All right. Well, so for you, here's another freebie. Last of the freebies on the Try By or Fry. Google has a new update that will merge your to-do lists with your calendar.
Why would
so
I want
if you're
that?
Android-like. If you've missed important to-dos in the past because you forgot to add it to both your calendar and your to-do list, Google just made it simpler to track both events and to-dos in one place. It's an update for Google Calendar called Reminders, which integrates many to-do lists into the current calendar interface. It looks pretty good. It's got a nice look to it. Of course, you know, some of these things, they make these really nice demos where it's got pictures in it and all that other stuff.
Right.
But who takes the time to, like, attach a photo to their to-do thing or their event or whatever to make it look really cool on
I've never really done that in real life.
I thought Google was already doing that with everything anyway.
The thing is, this was launched mobile first. It's not available yet on the web. That's coming down the road. Yet another signal of its shifting focus to make its services mobile-friendly first. This comes about a month after Smart Reply, the one we talked about last week, where it'll auto-respond tailored to individual emails on the Inbox app.
Hmm.
So, and then another Google thing. Their kind of iPad Pro competitor, the Google Pixel C. I don't know if there was not really a lot of buzz leading up to this, and then suddenly it's here and has reviews. So it's kind of one of those where, you know, they haven't learned the Apple thing, which is, yes, you keep it secure and make sure that it doesn't leak too early, but let enough leak that people know it's happening.
Yeah.
So they don't go buy something else if that was what they
This is cheap, too, isn't it?
Doing.
No,
unfortunately,
no, that's
no.
one of the things. It's not very cheap.
The Pixel C is a beautiful
bucks.
Android tablet that's just slightly bigger than the iPad Air 2.
Five's not bad.
Well, you have to pay another $150 if you want the keyboard.
Right? Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yeah.
$650 is a little bit different.
This tablet is the Pixel hardware team's response to the Surface and the iPad Pro. It's a simple, well-considered, uncomplicated glimpse into what a tablet computer ought to be, according to their team. Get on the train, it says. This is the future, except, well, according to this reviewer at The Verge, Google's Android and developer relations teams never even got to the station. They're saying basically that the hardware is great, but that then there's problems between it and the OS.
It suffers from a lot of Android problems. Now the Pixel devs did these guys, the Pixel C devs did a Reddit AMA just earlier today, and answered one of the big outstanding questions, which is how our update's going to be handled, because it's not going to work like a Nexus. But they said that they plan to push, I think they said monthly security updates to these things for Android. So that's good. But still, on the other hand, there are so many things about Android, even the current version of Android, that don't exactly adapt themselves well to the tablet-sized format, including the fact that most of the apps just, like, scale and give up. and they took out, apparently, at one point in development, they had multitasking, and they had the Android beta half-functional, like, run two apps at the same time thing operating, and they ripped it out. It's not in there right now for release. So it's a laptop-sized device that can run one app at a time with an expensive Bluetooth keyboard that you have to have if you want to use it like a laptop.
Which looks like it's stuttery.
with all of the, it's very stuttery. I know The Verge ran into that. We ran into that with ours. It was very, very stuttery.
But I like the fact that you've got a hard keyboard based where you can actually put it in your lap. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, like the, I guess like the Surface, the first couple services from Microsoft, it was the kind of rolly thing flappy, where you had to have keyboard. A table to be able to work on it. Yeah.
Well, it's got a 10.2-inch screen with 2560 by 1800, which you may notice by the way those numbers are sort of close to each other, that it is, it almost looks square. Mm. It's not really, it's not as rectangular as most. It is the same ratio as a standard A4 piece of paper.
So it's taking, it's kind of going up to the Microsoft Surface Book. A little taller, isn't it?
Could be, although it looks like the Surface Book, at least by the pictures I'm seeing, looks wider. You know, when you see the photo, it looks like the height to width ratio is tighter on the on the Pixel C. It looks nice. I mean, just the general appearance, it's got, you know, it's got a nice the design language on the outside for appearance. Let's see. It apparently the design language comes from the Chromebook Pixel, if you're familiar with that. It's not cheap. Like Lee said, it starts at about $500 for the 32 gig version, and then it's another $150 for the Bluetooth keyboard. That might not seem like too much. I mean, an iPad Air 2 with only 16 gigs costs the same, but, you know, this is in the Android tablet market. There's a lot of competition that is a lot cheaper. 3 gigs of RAM paired to the latest NVIDIA X1 64-bit processor. Let's see. The review says there are inexcusable pauses and latency, especially when launching and switching apps, which means that, according to this reviewer, his hunch is that the Android team hasn't figured out how to take real advantage of the power in the processor. That this is similar problems to the Nexus 9. And, you know, because it's too bad. They've got 3 gigs of RAM. That's kind of leading the in the tablet space. You know, it was just a big deal that Apple went to 2, and here they are at 3, but they're not getting – you have to get something out of it if it's going to be bigger. Let's see. According to the keyboard, that's what's genuinely new and interesting about it. It attaches to the tablet with magnets, closing up into a sealed little flat box in a mode that Google calls sunny side down. Interesting name. When closed, the tablet wirelessly charges the keyboard. You can attach the keyboard to the back with more magnets. That's sunny side up. But what you want to do with the keyboard is type, and there again you have yet more and more powerful magnets. I wonder, this thing has so many magnets. Can you, like, walk around with it without, like, being in danger of attaching yourself to a file cabinet or something, a piece of metal? There's a small hinge at the top of the keyboard that latches onto the back of the Pixel C, letting you pull it up to any angle you might want, and it sticks there, too, because the hinge is as sturdy as it can be without being obstinate. The Pixel C automatically detects whether the keyboard is attached and knows whether or not to show you the on-screen keyboard. So, you know, that if you may want to look at it and see what you like. Some on the reviews, people, the keyboard is not a full-size keyboard because it's a 10-inch tablet. So the Pixel team solution was they got rid of some less used keys like brackets and the tilde, which means that the keys you use most get to be bigger. So you do have to get used to it, but apparently that's pretty quick. There's also a little three-dot menu that you can hit to bring up a symbol keyboard on the screen. There are also some hidden secret keyboard combos for some symbols, which, you know, why do it secret hidden? I don't quite, you know, I don't think there's lots of, like, pad geeks out there who are like, okay, well, what if I hit this combination? What secrets? No. No, more likely you're going to go, hey, how did I get that? Because you were flapping your floppy hands around on the keyboard and suddenly got something you didn't expect. According to this reviewer, he liked it, except that there are problems with missing and repeating key presses. It seems to have a stutter step in the Bluetooth connection from time to time. When it drops, nothing registers for a few seconds. When it returns, FFFFF, literally and figuratively. I liked that part of the review. So, you know, it's sort of tough to see Google do something that has some interesting stuff. I guess the TLDR on this is, according to this reviewer, the Pixel team has mostly delivered something really good. The Android team has not. So the hardware is there, and hopefully they can grow into it. But, you know, it's unfortunate that when Google really takes the focus to this. It looks like they did something interesting with the keyboard, which everybody seems to be able to do that. That's where the innovation seems to show up. You look at the Microsoft Surface, and you look at the again with the Google Pixel C. They did clever things with the keyboard, but that's kind of on the Google Pixel C. It sounds like that's sort of where it topped out and it has issues. But
I like Android on the phone, but it's definitely not ready for anything larger. You know,
I liked it on the Nexus 7.
Note 3 or
it was
something.
Nice, and they of course dumped it. Mm-hmm. They got rid of it. You can actually the Nexus 7. You know, if you're still interested in them, I have seen they're around. I don't know if Asus continued to make them.
Are they
or if
still
there's
updating
just a lot
the OS
sitting around.
Though? I guess you could always
it
load your
takes
own.
I'm sure it takes updates. You know, because it wasn't underpowered or any of that. But they're about $100, which isn't for what it is, isn't bad. You know, it used to be a $229 deal. So if you're looking for a high-end Android tablet, well, maybe this meets your needs, and maybe it falls short. And then finally, it's Advent season, and this is what I would like to receive for Advent: the Taft's Ale House Liquid Advent Calendar. It basically is a. It's a big box with the dates for, you know, Advent. And when you fold up, there are little windows, and when you open the window, there's a beer behind each window.
It's like the chocolate calendar.
Yeah, except you get a whole beer.
And you're a full-blown alcoholic by the time Christmas rolls around.
And it's $72. It holds 24 16-ounce cans. That's not your basic 12-ounce. So it's like this isn't no 12 Days of Christmas stuff. This is 24. This is like a case of 16-ounce cans of liquid Advent beer. A chocolate brown porter brewed with cinnamon, chilies, cacao nibs, and roasted cacao husks from Maverick Chocolate Company. This is all from Cincinnati. I don't know that you can find it in Houston, and I think that Texas's alcohol laws, you may have to actually go to Cleveland to get it. So if you were going to spend $999 to get some Star Trek ticket or Star Wars tickets.
Star Trek tickets. I am going to get my Star Trek on.
That's all, JJ.
Hey,
here's what we need to do.
Oatmeal, XKCD, Star Trek, Star Wars.
We need to rent a theater and put Star Trek in it and just be real misleading. Star.
Star
discount Blarf. Tickets, half price tickets.
I think I looked that one up, and they're available in some states. I don't remember if Texas was one of them.
The tough part is
I was looking originally for the one that was for sale at Costco, but it's a very different one. It's not the same. I don't think the beer in it's probably
I'm
as good at all.
I'm seeing no distributors in Texas from their site. We've got some draconian beer law, so they probably don't distribute here.
They'd have to get a bunch of approvals.
Yeah, and there's a huge and it all has to go through the particular distribution channels. So some distributor has to have the rights to it or whatever. Which is too. Yeah, I saw the one at Costco and looked at what was in it, and it did not pass muster for me. Well, you'll have to do the weird science part yourself.
It was really weird.
We ran out of time.
Get sciencey.
Get weird. All right, well, thanks for tuning in to Technology Bites. Remember, the UnDrive is going on. If you want to make a donation to KPFT or you want to make a donation in support of Technology Bites, go by kpft.org and make a donation.
UnDrive.
UnDrive. Shh. You've been listening to Technology Bites, the UnShow. Technology Bites on KPFT. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Unflicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Unley.
And he's...
The UnCola.
Thank you.
2015 has been a year of triumph and tragedy, from the emergence of fresh new artists to the passing of some of the greats, from the major news stories that shape our world to the presidential election next year sure to determine our future. You may not know what 2016 holds, but you can keep your independent source alive so you get what you love and need. 90.1 KPFT Houston is a nonprofit radio station bringing you news, music, culture, and more 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We do not rely on advertising to power the radio you hear. We depend on listeners to contribute to keep it on the air. Every bit of help during this last stretch of the year helps. Maybe you want to get that year-end tax deduction, or maybe you want to give someone a gift membership to KPFT, or one of our fantastic t-shirts, mugs, or exclusive CD sets. Don't wait until the end of December. Give now at kpft.org. Thanks.
This season, we all think about giving back to others. This year, please don't forget about KPFT. Remember all that KPFT gives you. Whether you listen every day or you listen to us via podcast or streaming, we share what is great in Houston. Just visit kpft.org anytime before the end of the year to donate. Your gift at kpft.org will help share the programming you love to those who need it most. Please visit kpft.org right now to give your tax-deductible gift. Thanks. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.